Yes, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming. Just a little bit about myself, so you know who I am. I was a long time ago a physicist by background, and I studied for a PhD in atmospheric physics, and fell out of that fairly quickly, ended up working for an organization called the Committee on Climate Change, which was just getting set up in the UK. Working on climate science there, and was there for 9 very happy years. And just last autumn, I've moved into the government department. It's a bit of a mouthful, so I'll call it BEIS for short, where we do lead on climate science, particularly for mitigation of climate change. And I co-lead the team there. And so I've had about 10 years working on the science policy interface, I suppose, particularly with a view to tackling climate change at the UK level. And just to give you an idea about the climate science team in BEIS, what we do, the main things we do are we fund programs of climate research. The big one we fund is the Met Office Hadley Centre Climate Programme, but we also commission other research projects on particular topics. We also fund some Earth observations and monitoring systems. We also engage with research councils and other research institutes to understand the developing research base and how it's relevant to decision making on climate change, and also to engage them to try and help them to understand where they're interested in what can be useful for policy and what our research needs are. Another important thing we do is we help to compile and publish the UK's greenhouse gas emissions inventory. So we keep track of what the UK's emissions are, whether they're going up or down, where they're coming from. And that obviously plays an important role both nationally in meeting our targets and in the international process as well. And then also on the international stage, we are the body within government tasked with the UK's contributions to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. So we are responsible for the UK's share of funding that, also for helping to nominate UK-based authors, for instance, and then inputting when governments get around the table in plenaries to agree on the summaries for policymakers, for instance. And finally, of course, we're designed really as the kind of team to be the in-house experts on climate change in government. So we are there to make sure that people understand the basics of the case for action, why government is trying to do what it's doing across departments and at senior levels within our own department, but also to give specialist advice in technical areas of policy where they need to understand certain things that are within our remit. So that's a bit about what I'm doing these days. It was very kind of Rob to invite me to come and speak this evening, and I saw that the theme of these lectures this year was, I think it was, thinking creatively about climate change. So what I've tried to do is, rather than give a kind of standard spiel about how science and policy work together, I thought for your interest and mine, I'd try and take a bit more of a sideways look at the interrelationship between climate science and climate policy. There's a kind of traditional and slightly cliched view that, you know, scientists generate evidence, they find a problem and think about solutions, they take that very well-developed evidence base to policymakers think about it and sort of react to that information and may do something or may not do something. And a lot of the time that's true, and that does happen. There's an awful lot of research which has gone into identifying climate change as a risk, and you know, there can be a good argument made that policy making at the global level is not doing enough to tackle that risk. But also, I think you would well know this if you work in research or even if you work in policy, the truth can often be a lot more nuanced. So scientific researchers would readily admit there are some very big holes still in our understanding in areas where it would be useful to understand more. And policymakers are also often tasked with making decisions in areas of deep uncertainty, where a decision has to be made, something has to be done, and it may be that not all the information is there that one would ideally like. So this creates a fertile space for slightly unexpected and surprising things to happen. And So I thought the way I could do this was take you through just three stories I'm aware of in my career at the Science Policy Interface where I think surprising things have happened or unexpected things have happened. And I think they're interesting. I hope you'll find them illuminating as well as interesting. The first story I'm going to talk you through is about how a particular policy, in this case, one that gave government power to get reports on climate change adaptation from different public bodies, actually resulted in a whole kind of new frontier opening up, I think, and new needs for climate data, a very financially important frontier, as we'll see. The second story, the apple and orange in the middle, is about how we compare different greenhouse gases and how some scientific data that was published in a report kind of got picked up and took on a life of its own. And the third is about global ambition at the very highest level and the Paris Agreement. And hopefully I'm going to wrap up by showing you how they influence some research priorities today, certainly from a policy-making perspective. And with a bit of luck, I'll finish with plenty of time for questions as well at the end. So story number one, this is about adaptation reporting. And this one, in a sense, has developed in parallel with my own career, because this story starts with the Climate Change Act of 2008, which is really the legislation that the UK Parliament passed, which really underpins the climate policy architecture we have today in the UK. So we have a 2050 target that the UK is aiming to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by at least 80% below 1990 levels. We have a system of 5-year carbon budgets, limits on UK's emissions, designed to get us down there in an orderly fashion. And we also have a Committee on Climate Change, which was set up as an independent expert body to advise on what those targets should be and essentially monitor progress and say to government and parliament whether it thinks we're on track or not. Those were the kind of headlines. It was all about tackling climate change through emissions reduction. But there are some provisions in the Climate Change Act which are about adaptation. And certainly in 2008, this was much less headline grabbing. Things like there was a provision to create an adaptation subcommittee of the Committee on Climate Change, which is a bit of a mouthful too, so it tends to be called the ASC for short. But also the idea that we should have 5 yearly national climate change risk assessments to identify what are the risks from climate change to the UK. And that risk assessment is designed to feed into a 5-yearly update of a national adaptation programme. So in light of those risks, what do we need to prioritise to do about it? And buried deeper into the Climate Change Act, pretty much only for those who really want to read it from cover to cover, there's a provision called the Adaptation Reporting Power. And essentially, this gave government the power to request that certain public bodies with statutory duties to regulate could be asked by government to produce a report to say, what are you doing to make sure that your area of regulation is adapting to climate change, is preparing for the risks that a changing climate presents to the UK? Now, DEFRA is the department, so not the department I work in, but DEFRA is the one that has responsibility for climate change adaptation. And so the DEFRA Secretary of State has the power to write a letter to a public body and say, what are you doing about adaptation to climate change? So initially, this reporting power was used in the first trawl. It was very much focused on public bodies relating to physical infrastructure, the kind of stuff that you would obviously think needs to manage extreme weather and climate hazards. So we're talking water companies, electricity producers and distributors, communications and transport bodies. So, you know, Ofgem, Ofwat, and individual water companies, for instance, and organisations such as the Environment Agency as well. And this, I remember this being a bit of a learning experience for everyone involved, government and the reporting bodies, thinking, well, how do we get our head around this idea that we should adapt to climate change? What are the risks? How do they affect us? How do we measure? How do we show that we're doing something about climate change? And I remember when I was working in the Committee on Climate Change, we were handed about, it was over 100 reports and asked to assess them and say, do you think everyone's doing enough? So we spent a lot of time head scratching, thinking, well, how do we measure this? What are the metrics we use and what do we decide? So that's the adaptation reporting power in a nutshell. And it wasn't even in the first round, but it was in the second round. They widened it out to a wider range of bodies that DEFRA wanted to ask what they were doing on climate change. And it wasn't even in that, but it was in an extra set of bodies which they made an optional request to, that they asked the Bank of England, or more specifically the Prudential Regulation Authority, which is under the Bank of England, to look at what is the insurance sector doing about preparing for climate change. So this was a provision buried away in the Climate Change Act under the adaptation reporting power. It wasn't even the first time round, and it was an optional thing. So the Bank of England wasn't really under an obligation to do anything, but it was just asked if it could consider doing a report. And it's only through subsequent conversations I've had in further years that I've realised that the Bank of England didn't have a team of people working on climate change. But interestingly, this is in around about 2011 or maybe a couple of years on, they did have a stream of work looking at kind of long-term systemic risks to the financial sector, because this was a hot topic after the financial crisis of 2008. Climate change didn't really figure on that, but there were people working on long-term financial stability. There were one or two people working at the Bank of England who did understand that climate change might fit in this and had a personal interest in thinking about climate change in this context. So when the letter from DEFRA arrived on the Bank of England's doorstep to the governor of the Bank of England, they were interested and managed to persuade their managers to be given a bit of time to work on this. And the Bank of England thought, well, this is a request from the public sector, from DEFRA. Even though we're under no compulsion, it would be a good thing for us to do. So they produced a report back in 2015, dryly titled The Impact of Climate Change on the UK Insurance Sector, a Climate Change Adaptation Report by the Prudential Regulation Authority. But this was really quite groundbreaking in a way. So it came up with this conceptualization about what the risks of climate change are to the financial sector. Well, they were looking specifically at the insurance industry. But they said there are really three buckets of risk that climate change presents. One is the physical risks. So if you're invested in an asset somewhere and that is on the coast, that is exposed potentially to increased flooding through sea level rise. So that's a direct physical risk of climate change that you should be worried about as an insurance company. The second is transition risks. This is the photo in the middle about a coal mine. So if you imagine that the world really does get serious about strenuous mitigation, there are some assets you have which are going to be repriced. Some things, for instance, a coal mine might be devalued. Other risks may go up. So when I'm talking about risks, I'm talking impact times probability. So that could be a positive or a negative impact. So there are transition risks as well in your investments and your assets. And the third bucket is liability risks. So if people suffer loss and damage, they may come knocking on your door asking for recompense. That's a liability risk in some shape or form. Now, around the time that this report was published, the Bank of England got a new governor, Mark Carney, who took much more of an interest, a personal interest in this topic, and started to really actually push this issue up the agenda of what the financial sector is or could be doing about climate change. And I don't know if you remember, he gave a seminal speech on what he called the tragedy of the horizon for businesses at Lloyd's of London in autumn 2015. And since then, he's been quite involved in really pushing this up the agenda, as I said. He's played a leading role in this International Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. Through all these various activities that have been gaining pace, this conceptualization of climate risks to the financial sector more broadly has really sort of gained currency, which first came about through this report that was done back in 2015. And the idea of the TCFD, the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, it was tasked by G20 finance ministers, so this is not a UK thing, this is a global thing, to look at how large corporates should be disclosing climate risks to their shareholders. So that is physical risks, transition risks, and potentially liability risks as well. And since the TCFD has recently reported on its guidance, I think over 100 companies have endorsed the recommendations of the TCFD. These are big companies like Aviva, Bank of America, Glencore, I think Shell and Unilever as well. And what this guidance says is essentially that these corporates voluntarily should be disclosing their risks, including considering a 2-degree warming scenario. So if the world shifted onto a 2-degree consistent pathway or lower, what does that mean for your company? And you should be reporting that to your shareholders. So in other words, I think there's now the potential for a big increase in demand for climate data from financial companies, which are going to be thinking very seriously about disclosing their financial risks. That is climate data in the sense of what they might do in a low carbon future, but also climate data in terms of what their exposure to the physical hazards from climate change are. And more generally, the topic of green finance is an area of real focus for the UK government right now. They've formed a task force for green finance, which is going to be making recommendations on what the government can do in this space. The government recognises that, I think the number it uses is around 13 trillion pounds of investment is going to be needed in the energy sector alone to 2030 to steer us onto a Paris Agreement consistent path. And the government has officially endorsed the recommendations of the TCFD and said that it thinks every single company should be, every listed company should be implementing the recommendations. So I guess in a nutshell, this story is about how we went from a small clause in the Climate Change Act about adaptation to an optional request to the Bank of England to a few motivated analysts, and now we're seeing a major move towards sort of international engagement with climate information and climate data from the private sector. So that's story one. I want to move on to a second story, which is about emission metrics, how we compare different greenhouse gases. And rather than this being, in a sense, about a policy that took on a life of its own, like the last story, this is more about how numbers in the scientific report took on a life of their own. So you've probably heard that methane, which is the CH4, the apple on the right, is a greenhouse gas which is about 25 times more powerful than CO2. And this is indeed the way that methane and CO2 are accounted for in climate policies around the world. And actually, there are a range of different greenhouse gases. Some of you will be well aware of this. And they're all assigned a different CO2 equivalent value. So methane is 25. Nitrous oxide is more like 300. This metric, in this way, emissions of different gases can be aggregated together. So the UK's emissions targets and the nationally determined contributions, or essentially the pledges from different countries around the world, tend to be measured in CO2 equivalent emissions. They've gathered up all their emissions, multiplied methane emissions in tons by 25 to get the CO2 equivalent value, the equivalent value of, in tons of CO2, aggregated them all up to come up with a CO2 equivalent emissions value. And in this way, emissions of or reductions in emissions can be traded too. So if you avoid emitting a ton of methane, that's equivalent in this system to avoiding 25 tons of CO2 emission. And economists like this system because it gives you flexibility in trading off. You can work out what's the cheapest form of mitigation in CO2 equivalent terms. It gives you added flexibility and does reduce overall costs of mitigation in theory. So, for instance, just last week we released the final stats for the UK's greenhouse gas emissions in 2016, and they came out in terms of pure CO2, I think it was 379 million tonnes of CO2 the UK emitted in 2016. But in CO2 equivalent, for all the greenhouse gases we account for in our targets, the total was 468 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent. But I wonder how many of you know or understand where these numbers come from. So what does it mean that methane is a gas 25 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2? You'd be perfectly reasonable in thinking that it means that you get 25 times the global temperature rise that you do from CO2. perfectly reasonable, but wrong, it turns out. That's not what the metric is measuring. These numbers were first picked up for policy use when the Kyoto Protocol was set into motion in 1997, when policymakers did want to include a basket of greenhouse gases, not just CO2. I think partly for good reasons. CO2 is not the only greenhouse gas, partly for efficiency reasons. As I mentioned, you can trade off mitigation and have flexibility in how you meet your targets. But the metric is known as the 100-year global warming potential, and it was reported in the first IPCC assessment way back in 1990. This might be a little bit detailsy, but I just want to show you, because this is something I spent a lot of time on, so it kind of interests me at least, how the global warming potential works. This chart here shows two different curves. I want you to imagine this is emission of two different gases. And what's on the y-axis is something obscurely called RF, which is short for radiative forcing. It's basically a measure of the imbalance, the heat imbalance in the atmosphere you generate by sticking a greenhouse gas in there or anything else. So if you imagine that you inject a ton of CO2 into the atmosphere in year zero, that creates a certain radiative imbalance. And then you leave it, and gases tend to decay with a characteristic time scale over time. So imagine CO2 is the kind of blue-green lower curve here. It decays. CO2 is actually a slightly complicated gas. It doesn't have a single time scale for disappearing in the atmosphere. It has various different time scales on which it's cycled through different exchanged with natural sources and sinks. But basically, you start off with something in year zero, and the warming imbalance decays over time. And the global warming potential measures the integrated radiative forcing over a 100-year period. That's the 100-year global warming potential. Now, I've got two curves here. I want you to imagine a shorter-lived gas than the blue-green one, the yellow curve. It's shorter-lived, so this one decays on a characteristic timescale of about 10 years rather than 100 years for the other curve. But it's got a much more powerful initial kick. It traps more heat when it's there. And it turns out that these two gases, on a 100-year global warming potential basis, are equivalent. They have the same 100-year GWP. But of course, we're measuring radiative forcing here. We're not measuring temperature. Here's the actual impact on global temperature of these two gases. And you can see that although they have the same 100-year global warming potential, they only have the same temperature impact if you're looking at one specific year, about 30 years after you've emitted the thing. So the global warming potential essentially doesn't measure directly global average temperature. And you might ask yourself a number of questions here. You might think, well, why are we using 100-year time horizon? Why are we not using 50 or 200 or 10 years? Or even an economist might suggest, why are we not using a discount rate over time? And why are we measuring radiative forcing and not temperature? Well, part of the answer is actually when the Kyoto Protocol was put into place, for those who remember back in 1997, we didn't have a globally agreed quantified target for limiting warming. So the 2-degree limit was not globally agreed at the time. There was simply a statement under the UNFCCC that we needed to avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system, and we needed to stabilize concentrations, but it didn't say at what level. So in a sense, it's understandable that because we didn't have an agreed overarching quantified target, there wasn't necessarily agreement over the right metric to get us there. Also, radiative forcing is much easier to measure than global temperature response. When you try to think about the global temperature response of different gases, you have to fold in a lot more uncertainties about how the climate system behaves. But the interesting thing about this story is I just want to show you what was in the original IPCC assessment report. So I said these numbers came about because essentially scientists who contributed to this first IPCC assessment put some numbers in. Here's the table with some numbers. It's got the global warming potential, and you'll see that they looked at different integration time horizons. So 100 years was one, but they also looked at 200, they looked at 500. And in the caption for this table, it says global warming potentials following instantaneous injection of 1 kilo of each trace gas relative to carbon dioxide. So that's the metric we have. And then it says a specific example of an application of these potentials is given in table 2.9. Just turns out that in table 2.9, they used the 100-year set. And there's this fantastic bit of text, actually, in the report. I love this. It must be stressed that there is no universally accepted methodology for combining all the relevant factors into a single global warming potential for greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, there may be no single approach which will represent all the needs of policymakers. A simple approach has been adopted here to illustrate the difficulties inherent in the concept, to illustrate the importance of some of the current gaps in understanding, and to demonstrate the current range of uncertainties. I can imagine that quite a few people who contributed to this report were maybe scratching their heads at the fact that this got used. But of course, the issue is these were the only numbers they provided, and policymakers needed a tool to put into their policy, and so they picked up these numbers. Now, subsequent IPCC assessments have discussed alternatives to the global warming potential, including some which may be more directly relevant to the global targets we have now. But the 100-year global warming potential remains the metric in use for policy. It's proven remarkably sticky. And if you think about it, maybe it's easy to see why. When you start changing metrics, the basis on which all emissions targets are based, you start creating winners and losers. So if you imagine a country which has an awful lot of methane compared to CO2 emissions, if you switch to a policy metric which maybe represented long-term temperature better, it would devalue methane. So methane is around in the atmosphere for 10 or so years. But after several decades, the climate system in terms of global average temperature will have largely forgotten about it. So using a multiplier of 25 probably overvalues the long-run temperature impact of methane. Of course, if you care about short-run temperature, 25 may be better. But if you're thinking long-run temperature, methane is probably overvalued. So if you switch to a metric which represented that, it would be great for a country with a huge quantity of methane emissions, because suddenly their CO2 equivalent emissions would drop. Methane would be worth less. But if that country was banking on a lot of its mitigation for a target in 2030 coming from the fact that it could easily cut methane, it's suddenly going to be a lot harder to meet the target, because methane mitigation is worth less. So I think this debate, my personal view is this debate may come back in the future for reasons I'll come back to later on. But let's move on to the third story. This is about the Paris Agreement and the 1.5-degree limit. The Paris Agreement, of course, is one of the biggest landmarks in the history of climate action, if not the biggest. I'm sure you're all aware of the Paris Agreement and broadly what it says. It's the first truly global agreement, in the sense that essentially all countries are committing to take action to reduce emissions. There's no split now between developed and developing nations. And everyone has, pretty much every country has committed to a pledge to take action on emissions. Not only that, but of course it shifted the level of overarching ambition. So previously, you'll know that ever since the Copenhagen Accords, written into UN-level agreements was this idea that we're aiming to limit warming to 2 degrees or below. But at Paris, this new aim emerged. The new overarching target is to stay well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels and to pursue efforts to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. And by the end of the Paris negotiations, actually, 106 countries were endorsing the 1.5-degree limit. So this had really widespread support. But maybe I can do a little show of hands. Maybe I can ask you, who was expecting before the Paris Agreement was signed that 1.5 degrees would be included in the overarching aim of the agreement? Any hands up? No. It's possibly unfair to ask the one person who did see it coming to stick their hand up when everyone else keeps them down. It's fair to say it was a major surprise. I mean, it surprised even me. I wasn't directly involved in the negotiations, but I was surprised when I saw what happened. In the discussion about long-run limits to global warming, the discussions have progressed over various tracks. So there have been discussions about whether we should have a target which is a safe concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, 450 ppm, 550 ppm, some people arguing for 350 ppm. Or there have been discussions about whether it should be an emissions target, so 50% reduction by 2050, for instance. But there's also been a long history of discussing a temperature target, and that has almost invariably been 2 degrees. So we can trace this back to in the 1970s, there's a climate economist, there still is, called William Nordhaus in the States, who wrote a paper where he discussed what an appropriate level for limiting global warming might be. And he suggested, given that it looks like going back through deep history, climatic fluctuations have been around plus or minus 2 degrees, it might be safe to stay within that range. And so he proposed a global warming limit of about 2 degrees. Although freely admitting in his paper that the whole process of trying to choose a target was deeply unsatisfactory, which I think is a point many people can relate to in this. 2 degrees came to the political fore when there was a council of German scientific advisors who advised the German government in a report in 1995 that 2 degrees should be about the right limit, again on the basis of looking at historical climate variations. And this was picked up by the European Union, which endorsed this. So the first political statement about a temperature target was 2 degrees. That was the European Union in 1996. And of course, there was an awful lot of effort to try and get this into international agreement. The focus was always about 2 degrees. But actually, by the time of the Paris Agreement, 1.5 degrees had some history. So there's a negotiating block within the UN. There's a band of countries together under the banner of the Association of Small Island States. They commissioned a report by the German research center PIC at Potsdam, looking at the impacts on their nations of 2 degrees. And certainly, the negotiator from Tuvalu, one of the small island states, went on record saying that 2 degrees would be disastrous for Tuvalu. And so this negotiating bloc formed around the idea that the target shouldn't be 2 degrees, it should actually be well below 1.5 degrees. And they went into the Copenhagen climate negotiations in 2009 arguing for a 1.5 degree limit. Now, this wasn't shared by all the developing nations. So I don't think it was the position of China and India, for instance. And so as I understand it, there was a bit of friction because some people were saying this is a distraction, this is splitting the position of the developing nations. But nonetheless, this was the ask. And for those who sought to look hard enough in the text of the Copenhagen Accord, yes, it says that the aim is to limit warming to well below 2 degrees, but it actually called for a discussion of a review to look at 1.5 degrees. So with the benefit of hindsight, maybe this shouldn't have been as much of a surprise as it was, and there was a commitment to do a structured expert dialogue amongst parties with scientific experts to look at a 1.5 degree limit. But despite the fact that this was endorsed by several dozen countries, and this was in the text to review it, even in the IPCC's fifth assessment, so we're now looking at 2013, 4 years after the Copenhagen Accord, if you look for information about what would be the appropriate global pathway to limit warming to 1.5 degrees, there is remarkably little data from the scientific community. So this is a table taken from the fifth assessment report looking at different global emissions reduction pathways. On the left, we have the CO2 equivalent concentrations at the end of the century. And then the important thing really is on the right, where you see likelihood of staying below a specific temperature level. There's 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees. And as you go down the table, you're essentially looking at higher stabilization levels, so more warming. And you see categories like likely warming over 4 degrees, more unlikely than likely, about as likely as not. All of these categories for which the IPCC has been confident enough to give data, for which there's enough scientific information out there, at the very best, they say more unlikely than likely that you would stay below 1.5 degrees. Except there's one category at the top stabilization at less than 430 parts per million, where it says only a limited number of individual module studies have explored levels. So this is the category which could credibly give you, you know, a better than evens chance of staying below 1.5 degrees. And this is the IPCC essentially saying, we don't have enough data to feel comfortable giving any numbers about this, because in the published scientific literature, there isn't enough data. So the world was in a position where several dozen countries supported a limit of 1.5 degrees since at least 2009, but there wasn't much scientific literature on how to achieve it. But of course, hindsight is a wonderful thing. When parties went into the Paris negotiations looking for a global deal, it seems fairly sensible to think that the voice of those several dozen nations is going to be a key input into what that agreement should say. And of course, we ended up with a situation where 1.5 degrees wasn't just written as a further footnote where that we have no information, but it's actually hardwired into the text around the overarching ambition. We're in a situation essentially where the policy has jumped ahead of the scientific evidence, and the text of the Paris Agreement actually asks the IPCC to go away and to tell the UN what is the appropriate level of global emissions in 2030 that will be compatible with the 1.5 degree limit. So in this story, I guess a lot of science had focused on one policy target, and there was another policy possibility which was largely left untouched by research, unexplored for whatever reason. And then political events conspire to suddenly bring this alternative right into the foreground, and it's a big surprise, and it suddenly generates an urgent need to do some research. So I guess those are my three stories in a nutshell, and I just want to touch on briefly a few priorities for scientific research that I think come out of them, and then hopefully leave some time for questions. So 1.5 degrees is a very good place to start. As I said, there are some very immediate focus research questions that came out of the Paris Agreement. So the IPCC is now doing its special report on 1.5 degrees and needs to come back and say what is the level of 2030 emissions it views is compatible. There could be a good argument made that a lot of research wasn't put into 1.5 degrees because it's just not feasible. It's important to remember there were some very senior, reputable experts who were saying even before the Paris Agreement that 2 degrees wasn't feasible anymore. But I think it's interesting to note that since the Paris Agreement, there have been some big research projects with these big climate economy models, which actually essentially form the basis of how global emissions targets are set and how levels are defined as being compatible with a given temperature limit. There are more recent studies coming out now where those climate economy models are coming out with pathways which are 1.5 degree consistent. Now, a lot of them involve temporary overshoot and coming back down, but it doesn't seem to be that there was a fundamental issue with the models which made 1.5 degrees impossible. So I think the 1.5 degree conversation, as well as generating some immediate research priorities, may lead us to ask some slightly more subtle and nuanced questions about what the feasibility space, as I've termed it, of mitigation is. So a lot of a question is, do we have the right tools, or at least a kind of healthily diverse set of tools to understand mitigation pathways to limit warming to really ambitious levels? A lot of the models we use, they're real feats of software design and engineering and modeling, but they tend to involve a very traditional economic paradigm where individuals all act together as classically rational actors. You have partial or general economic equilibrium in the global system. So there's a question, do we have a real diverse set of models that goes beyond that? To what extent are the pathways a function of semi-transparent assumptions, such as a discounting of the future? How well do these pathways capture the full impacts of both climate change and some of the mitigation measures that are being discussed here? I mean, you'll see a lot of these pathways that I've shown here, of the ones that could be interpreted as consistent with the Paris Agreement, they involve a lot of negative emissions towards the second half of the century, or what we call greenhouse gas removals. these days. That is fundamentally planting an awful lot of trees and growing an awful lot of biomass and then combusting it for energy and sequestering the carbon. And I think there are some big questions about, and these are very live questions, which, you know, these modelers and others are exploring about to what extent is that really feasible and what are the impacts. How well do we model the innovation and diffusion of new technologies throughout society? And have we really interrogated the scope for changes in demand and societal attitudes? I think these are kind of really big questions which the mitigation community is really grappling with at the moment. So as well as the 1.5 degree limit highlighting the very real risks to, you know, the small island states and the least developed nations, I hope that it will stimulate a bit of a discussion to give us a more nuanced understanding of what the limits to adaptation are, and also what the opportunities and trade-offs around really ambitious mitigation are. Then I talk briefly about emissions metrics, and this gets interesting when you start talking about a net zero world as well. So you'll remember the Paris Agreement, as well as talking about limiting temperature to well below 2 degrees and pursuing efforts to 1.5 degrees, talks about in order to achieve that, we need a balance of greenhouse gas sources and sinks in the second half of the century. And this is a very typical sort of stylized emissions pathway that kind of statement draws on. To be compatible with 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, you generally see, if you measure emissions in CO2 equivalent, and the eagle-eyed will notice I've made a mistake here, I've plotted billion tons of CO2 on the y-axis. The green line is CO2 equivalent. So if you aggregate all greenhouse gas emissions using the global warming potential I mentioned, you'll see that even those emissions go down to net zero in a lot of, this is a typical looking pathway that's described as Paris consistent. The way they do that is often there are some sources of greenhouse gas emissions, non-CO2 emissions in particular, that just look fundamentally hard to get to zero, especially methane and nitrous oxide emissions from agriculture. Some CO2 emissions look difficult from aviation, for instance, and shipping. So the way these models tend to get to net zero in greenhouse gas equivalent or CO2 equivalent terms is they suck a lot of CO2 out of the sky through afforestation, through biomass with carbon capture and storage. The issue with this is that if we're using a 100-year global warming potential metric, which doesn't really directly correlate to our temperature goals, is that creating any perverse incentives? Now, that may not be an issue when we're up near the 2010s, 2020s, emitting gigatons of greenhouse gases. But when you get to net zero, you can imagine that, you know, if you start playing around with your metrics, you can make a difference quite easily of half a gigaton of CO2 in terms of needing to reach this balance. If you imagine that non-CO2 greenhouse gases are worth less than is implied here by the global warming potential, that means that to meet an overall CO2 equivalent pathway, the green line, maybe you can get away with emitting a bit more CO2. So if you're just running on the basis of these CO2 equivalent targets, you can play around with things and, you know, 500 million tons of CO2, that's equivalent to a few hundred million hectares of forest planted or not. So I think there's a question, particularly as we start thinking more seriously about net zero world, of are we using the right metrics and incentivizing the right balance between short-lived greenhouse gases and long-lived greenhouse gases in particular. Just finally, talking about the private sector and climate-related financial disclosures, I think we've been in an era where, until recently, a lot of the climate science translation work that's been done has been done for governments in the context of trying to get national and international level agreements where governments are going to commit to action. I think what we're seeing with these policy developments around not just big corporate companies, but also cities and individual community movements getting into climate action, I think we're seeing a burgeoning need for climate science information that is translated to those organizations, as well as continuing to need it for governments. And I think, you know, Cambridge University has done a lot of good work on this. I know about the Institution for Sustainability Leadership and other efforts to actually try and take what climate science and scientists know and translate that to people in the private sector, for instance. So I think there's going to be a really big agenda about how do we make sure that the right climate information is reaching the private sector and organisations apart from governments. And part of that is going to be about the availability of data. So is the data that we're collecting that might be useful, publicly available, usable, out there, you know, on a server somewhere that, and accessible for people? Part of it is going to be about helping with guidance. So when it says, for instance, in the TCFD recommendations, companies should think about 2 degrees scenarios, what does that mean for a company? How does it go about thinking about that? But I also think if you think about the huge diversity of businesses and what they do and what they use, from, you know, pharmacological companies right through to insurance firms to big mining firms, from international conglomerates down to, you know, the small corner shop on the road. I very much doubt there's going to be a one-size-fits-all approach to providing climate science data. And what that suggests to me is I'm not sure that just a few people putting data on servers is going to be enough. And I actually think there might be a demand for people who are well-versed in climate science, trained up in scientific areas, just to communicate with other people. I think there's a lot to be said for actually going out and talking and understanding the needs of different users. And given that there might be potentially a lot of users out there in the future, both thinking about carbon footprinting, but also the kind of physical risks from climate that people care about, we might need a lot more people who are trained up with a climate science background, but who work not just in academic centres, but in consultancies and within companies to help them get their heads around these risks. So, I think governments recognise the importance of climate information. I think now we're getting to a stage where lots of other people are also increasingly recognising the importance of climate information. And so I think in the long run, climate science is looking pretty healthy, and there are plenty of opportunities for people in this space to continue to be in work for quite a lot while longer. So that's good news for those of you in the room. But I'll finish there. So thank you very much for your time and throw it open to questions. Thank you.